the kind of the daily life of your experience, I mean, at least in moments within the Egyptian military, essentially. I think this, for me, was, I was very interested in understanding your work because it was a little window into an institution that is centrally important in Egypt, but also for the whole region, Eastern Mediterranean region. So maybe we could just first start, could you just introduce yourself, and we can get into some of the details in a moment, but just say the name of your project and kind of some of the main motivations of working on it.
So my name is Mahmoud Khattab. I'm a photographer and a writer based out of Cairo, Egypt. I recently moved to Switzerland, and my first book that I self-published recently is titled The Dog's Hat, Where We Parted. It is a collection of photographs that I discreetly took while I served as a conscript in the Egyptian military between the years of 2017 and 2018, together with writings that I did during the time of 1 year of conscription. And this explores the notion of a soldier who tries to remind himself of who he is during these times, and during a heavily discussed topic around Egyptian youth, which is serving in the Egyptian military. It became so forcefully installed upon us that it became by default a year or 3 years of wasted time that you have to go through. You have to throw your dignity out of the door, and you have to just do it. And it became, in a way, a sense of paying debt to the country, a debt with our that we pay with our bodies and with our time, with our servitude. And little is thought of it that through so many generations, because it's only recent, with Muhammad Ali from the Alevite family that introduced this, literally called sukhra in Arabic, which means a worker that's not paid or little paid. And the meaning that became attached to it in recent collective memory was it being a factory of men. A place where, because you have to go there, you have to get meaning out of it. And through these forced hierarchies and hardcore survival through terrains and crushing your spirit, you learn to be a man. And this didn't sit well with me. I knew this before I joined in. And before I did, I thought it was a year that's going to be wasted. And I really had a hard time in the first 2 months of my service. It was a year and 2 months. And this story was meant neither as a book nor an exhibition. It was really something that came as a cathartic measure to myself, someone who had enough agency of thought to question or linger a little bit on commands in the first 2 months. And these are the first 2 months you go through in training, and they're very crucial in an institution of the military institution in Egypt as much as anywhere else in the world, because this is where you primarily get rid of the sense of the individual and join a collective. The collective is not a political or not ideological, but a collective in a sense of behavior. You are no more of you're no less of a group and no more of a person. But in a way, I didn't want to absolve us of this choice of agency of thought, because so much of the crimes that happens around us usually gets defended in a sense that, hey, I was forced to do it. I was commanded to do it. I was only following orders. But 2 months into it, I wanted to pursue this idea of reminding myself who I am, to cling on as much of agency of thought, of writing, of seeing the things that I wanted to see. And over time, that became the thing that made me feel really comfortable during these hard times.
Well, I really liked this intimacy that I could feel in the photos that you shared, just in the sense that you feel this sort of soft camaraderie between the other people that you see in the images. And I thought it was very moving to sort of think about the existence of that soft humanity in all spaces. And actually, despite sort of understandings of the institutional frameworks, most contexts only persist because of the majority of time being spent in a context of people caring for each other, even if those structures are manipulated by, you know, corrupt officials or for political aims. That sort of softness that I felt was a very meaningful reminder that that sort of sense of humanity is carried into a lot of spaces. And in a way, that felt like one of, I liked that because it felt like that's one of the few things we can hold on to today, is if that sense is validated and lift, and there's an effort to lift that up, that's maybe something we can start with in the face of so much injustice.
It's true, because I think this sense of solidarity through compassion and, of course, intimacy is something so powerful, Stefan, that it ends up helping in this collective reconciliation. And so much of the intimacy that you see in the book were of soldiers who previously beat me so hard. In the beginning, in the first 2 months of my service, I think they were driven into this because military institutions will tend to punish or force someone into obeying commands, not through punishing them, but have the group that they're assigned to punish them. It is one of the most efficient. I learned this having to, you know, reflect back on my experience, because if you have enough agency of thought and you are forced to join an army and you are given a command, the first thing that you intuitively think of as Stefan is this going to be to my help, my best interest? If I obey this command, is this going to affect my safety, my well-being? And these few seconds of lingering on a thought to an institution as big as a military that depends so much on the chain of commands that go all the way down to the good obeying soldier, that means they have failed to train you. They have failed to condition you to be ready to obey a command. And one of their tactics, and it's not something that is modern, it is something as old. We live in a very much conventional army's tactics. They assign you to a group of soldiers, of other soldiers, not ranking officers, of other soldiers. And if any one of you linger on a command or disobeys a command, the rest of the group gets punished. And if someone else from the group lingers on a command or disobeys a command, you get punished. And the punishment here varies. It's not physical, but the punishment can be of, hey, you don't get to eat for another 2 hours. You don't get to see your family for another week. And if you live in the desert for 30 days and someone tells you you won't see your family for another week, that's enough reason to be incredibly violent. And I've seen this. My choice to find intimacy in the same soldiers was a choice of healing, in a way. If I showed them how much close I am, because I think it's not an individual experience. It happens to almost everyone. The same soldiers who beat you end up becoming your brothers in a way at the end of the service. And so most of these visuals having the nature of intimacy, it was the environment that grew afterwards. And this pretty much helps everyone. And I think it's one of the responsibilities that I thought of afterwards, that I think it's not saying in the same line of being intimate to our abusers or to our people who abused us, but in this context, it's very specific to soldiers, because conscripts are all experiencing the same power dynamics. And so this was among peers. It was not among an abuser versus abused, but it was among a group of people who suffered the same condition, which is very, very, very specific to that context.
Having heard so much discussion about the Egyptian military and the Palestine solidarity movements going back to the 1970s, and the role of Egypt at that time, and then moving forth, you know, of course, the student movements in Cairo and throughout Egypt for Palestine have been so important, and also always have sort of intersected with critiques of the government. And in that sense, there's been a big repression of that movement. It's interesting to see that a lot of people who are actually students who are participating in that movement also have to engage with the Egyptian military as an institution. And I was also thinking about that when I saw your photos. Just love to hear your thoughts about that, sort of the complexities there.
Thank you, because this is quite a complex issue, not in terms of understanding, but in terms of trying to find a way out or a way forward. I think we have become stuck in a sense of this ghost of gratitude, because some of the things that are most used that help military governments or military systems in pretty much in North Africa, namely Egypt and Algeria, they use the part of the collective fighting against repression as a way to claim ownership of control. Like for Algeria, the Algerian army using the context of fighting against the French as enough ground for them to control pretty much everything. The same in Egypt, using the 1973 war in which my uncle fought and got lost and died from injury. It is pretty much used in that political structure or legitimacy of the military. It's not hidden. We've been living in military dictatorship that became so intense since the 2013 the coup d'etat that happened. And at this point, we have more than 60,000 political prisoners, and a lot of them are people who committed no crime. They did not rob a bank. They did not produce ill among communities or societies. They were merely part of a political party or took part in a protest, shared an opinion online, or wrote or took part of an interview somewhere, and they're there. And if the best chance that anyone would get, if they have somewhat of a international recognition, they can get out in 1 or 2 years. And that is a really difficult moment for people to try to negotiate their way out with the system, knowing so much that You can talk your way all you want with politicians. You know there is a real actor behind all of this who you have to convince one way or another to take a step. But they are not there to negotiate with the rest of the public. So it's created this tension where people are trying to act. There are students who make solidarity groups for Palestine in universities, in Cairo University, and they're immediately arrested. People who hold banners, or recently people who were collecting donations for Taqiyya in Palestine, Gaza, to help feed families there, and they're arrested as well. And this would take you to a longer conversation on the complicity and the nature of this passive engagement, or what seems to be passive engagement to our public understanding of the current genocide that's been taking place.
I thought of one of the reasons that the photos really stood out to me was also just to think about sort of a Western Europe, North American discourse about militaries in progressive spaces, which is coming from such a radically different experience. You know, if we're talking about the context in Egypt, you mentioned Algeria. There could be many other examples where conscription is a reality, right? And also there's a very different history in relation to anti-colonial struggles and how national discourses are tied up to that. And I thought that this was an interesting opportunity. Of course, your photos are very beautiful, but to sort of look at those complexities. So I loved the project. Maybe you could just share any final thoughts about why you made such an effort to share this work right now, in regards to your own artistic journey, but also anything else you'd like to share, and also where people can learn more about your work online.
Thank you. So my decision to publish this work was pretty heavy one, because so many of my friends, especially some of them are my mentors, who are great photographers in Egypt, they warned me to take my photographs down or not pursue this as something that could be published. And I listened to them. This story was in the drawers for 2 years. But something encouraged me to pursue this story so much, because it has a healing aspect. It was a cathartic practice to me. But also, to give you a quick context, visuals and especially visual stories from conscription in the Egyptian army, they are rarely seen, almost never been published, in a sense that most of the photographs you would see to us as Egyptians in newspapers, they're all drills. There's someone who, they get someone who take photographs of people, and they have to be well dressed, and they have to be somewhat choreographed to do a certain practice. And to me, the statement of secrecy was important, because I wanted to discuss this from a personal perspective. My most important aspect was reminding myself of who I was. There was the term of the political use of that story, because it engages in a political discussion of forced military conscription. But having lived in Egypt long enough, I too am affected by censorship and having to navigate certain lines so that we can talk about things without having ourselves in jail, end up in jail the next day. There are so many artists, so many writers that we lost track of. They are still in jail. And, you know, someone would ordinarily say, okay, I could take asylum protection somewhere and publish these images. But I wanted to create this discussion around this concept of the good obeying soldier, of what it would take to remind ourselves of who we are, to claim agency again the next time we are given a command, we are told to do something. Because I was lucky enough that I was never asked to do harm on someone else. Yet I question, what would I have done in that context? Because 2 months into my service, I was pretty much a good soldier. I was an obeying soldier. If somebody would throw dishes off the table, I would go pick them up if they told me to. And that scared me. That scared me a lot because that worked on me. And that would not absolve me if I did harm on someone else, if I were asked to shoot someone else. And this was a trial, a personal trial, to just tackle this question of reminding ourselves of who we are, in a sense, in a hard environment, both terrains and the hierarchies of men that force us to do things that we don't want, we never thought we would. And that's pretty much what drove me to do it and to engage in this story, because forced conscription is in a lot, it still happens around the world. And I wanted to create this conversation. I still have this conversation with so many people from around the world who could find my work and could relate to it and would tell me their stories of conscripts maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And it's not sharing out of reminiscence of good times, but sharing of relating to how it felt to them as a soldier, of having to pay debt with their bodies and with their time. And this is something that I really wish to see or create something not as big, but something as personal as my story, for the few people who could come across it. Currently, the book is it's facing challenges to be, because I could only print it in Egypt. I could not afford to print it in Europe, and so I had to get it out in a very discreet way. I could get it out. I did not have the ISBN from Egypt. I had it from Switzerland, and so I constantly tried to look for people who could smuggle a few copies or carry it with them, so it could be shipped outside, from outside, of course. It's in stocks in few bookstores in both France and Switzerland, but they are very welcome to check my website as well for more details in that sense.
We'll share the link on the archive page for Free City Radio, which is soundcloud.com/freecityradio, and Mahmoud, your website is mahmoudkatab.com, and that's going to be in the links. Thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you so much, Stefan.
That was a conversation with Egyptian photographer Mahmoud Khatab. Thank you again for being on the show, Mahmoud. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., at 8 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m., also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find more information on our archive link at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.
the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
Studio 6, CGSS Video Series, captures high-quality video recordings of live performances.
So, who are you?
That's a bad question. We're necking.
It's a
lucky
question.
We're a man.
Continue music with impactful and inspiring artists.
We weren't very good at keeping it a secret.
As well as engaging conversations with community members about the issues that are most important to their communities. Watch all of the Studio 6 live sessions on CJSF's YouTube page or on our website at CJSF.com.